This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, you'll get an update on tourism on the Central Coast and in the city of SLO.
Even though the drive market is really our bread and butter, our fly markets are just taking off.
Also, you'll learn to make tortillas with Father Ian.
You want to make sure that that dough is very soft to get the texture you want for your tortillas.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, June 27th, 2022. I'm Carol Tangeman. Let's start with agenda breakdown.
Welcome to Agenda Breakdown, a podcast that explores how cities and counties make decisions and how you can have a say. I'm Kim Bischoff, and today we're going to talk about the parklets in San Luis Obispo, how they came to be, how people feel about them, and how long those parklets will stick around. Early in the pandemic, when COVID restrictions kept businesses from letting customers indoors, business owners were really struggling. So the city of San Luis Obispo launched a pilot program that let restaurants and retailers move some of their operations outdoors. That's when we started seeing parklets appear in front of restaurants on city streets. The one-year program was called Open SLO, and it was so successful that last July, City Council asked staff to transition it from a temporary program to a permanent one. Next month, the program will go back to City Council to determine what that will look like. I have two guests here today to help us understand where the parklet program is headed. Adam Fukushima is the active transportation manager with the city of SLO, and Luke Schwartz is transportation manager. Welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having us on.
So Adam, first question is for you. For any listeners who may not be aware, how would you describe a parklet?
Sure. So just quite simply, it's just the removal of a parking spot to provide a structure for outdoor dining. And so during the pandemic, this was really something that was useful for folks to social distance, as well as to just get outside and get out of the house and do something, you know, outdoors, and also to support our local businesses. And this is different than our other outdoor dining options that we have. So there's parklets, which is the removal of a parking spot. And there's also sidewalk cafe. So those things are areas on the sidewalk that are cordoned off by a fence where you can do outdoor dining as well too. So you may know that by Mint and Craft. And then there's things like just tables and chairs permits, where you just have tables and chairs on the sidewalk.
And for the part that's going to City Council next month, is that dealing with both of those options or just the ones that are in parking spots?
It's mostly parklets. Parklets is what we need an ordinance for, but we're also proposing some cleanup to the sidewalk cafe and tables and chairs permits, just to make sure that both programs are sort of congruent with each other and match.
Luke, the Open SLO parklets first appeared in May 2020. How have they changed since then?
In spring of 2020, at the throes of the COVID pandemic and a lot of restrictions on indoor services and dining, we kind of went into triage mode and started trying to set up temporary parklets for any businesses that could otherwise not operate without them. So originally, we had actually established kind of one pilot installation over at Big Sky that did include decking that was flush with the sidewalk and some railings. And then all of a sudden, we had a need for, you know, dozens more. So we were scrambling to get as many water barricades and concrete barricades as we could to set them up on the street. And they were pretty crude at first, with most tables set up at the street level, which was not great from an accessibility standpoint. And so since then, we've worked with all of the parklets that are still remaining to bring their decking and installations up to ADA compliance, so they're accessible and flush with the sidewalk, while also encouraging and helping businesses that wanted to invest in more aesthetically pleasing installations. So whether that's crafting kind of wooden barrier systems with planters built into them, or metal frames, even some that have moved forward and designed and get permitted for like roofing systems and lighting that are really nice and more permanent looking. So we still have a couple that maybe don't meet the type of aesthetic quality that we're looking to move towards, but a lot of them are actually looking really nice already.
I've noticed that there's a big difference in how they look. And I'm just wondering, who pays for those parklets, both the construction and any fees that are involved?
Right now, we're still in the pilot program, so there is no charge to use it. There are no fees, but we'll be transitioning to a fee structure. For the parklet structure itself, the city actually provided a number of minimal parklet structures to get people on their feet and going. But going forward to the permanent program, they will need to propose a structure that they will build. And so we've seen in other cities that the cost for that can range from $10,000 to $30,000, depending on how fancy you want to get.
That was my next question. I'm glad you gave me a number there. I was wondering, you know, some of those are so elaborate and so beautiful, and it seems like there's quite a big range in terms of, you know, just having some metal bars around the parking spot to the wooden benches and tables and heat lamps and roofs and plants and all that.
There's a huge range. There's parklets in San Francisco that I've seen that would cost, you know, $60,000-$70,000, were custom made out of stainless steel by big companies. But it really, there's a range of different ways to make them look nice.
Since people are spending so much money, or business owners are spending so much money to get these looking the way they want them to look, have there been any issues with vandalism or parklets being misused?
We've had a few instances with people having plants stolen, planter boxes knocked over. It hasn't been very frequent. I think more of the issues we've heard concerns with are with the businesses themselves maybe not keeping the spaces as tidy as they could and not activating them regularly. So that's something we've been working with businesses on and will be a firm requirement moving forward into a permanent program to keep the spaces clean, sanitary, and in a good state of repair.
And what makes a successful parklet? What's the difference between one that's successful and one that's not doing so well?
Parklets are by design are temporary structures and extensions of the sidewalk. Successful parklet should feel like a seamless extension of the environment that it's adjacent to. You know, have high quality aesthetic design. While being creative, it should echo and complement the adjacent buildings and streetscape. And also just be well used. Parklet that's sitting empty for a majority of the day is not adding to the environment. It's not what we're looking to encourage. So I think something that looks like that really provides an additional realm in terms of activity, making a place worth walking to and visiting, is really important in trying to build a successful parklet program.
You're listening to Agenda Breakdown. I'm Kim Bischoff, and I'm here today with Adam Fukushima and Luke Schwartz from the San Luis Obispo Department of Public Works. Over the past year, I know your department has hosted a bunch of workshops and sent out surveys, and you have had a lot of dialogue with business owners and also the general public. What did you learn from those conversations?
Yes, we got a lot of good feedback that came in, and I would say it's varied. I would say about half of it is complete support for a parklet program, and that it supports the pedestrian feeling downtown in a human scale environment. People really like that, and it supports our downtown concept plan and our active transportation plan. The other side is, you know, we've heard some concerns about it as well. One of the big themes is just idleness, the need for these parklets to be used. And so one thing we're proposing is a certain minimum level of activity. And that can be hard to define because we want to find a balance between having a certain level of activity that suits the community. People want to see these things used, but at the same time, having something that isn't too burdensome on a restaurant. And, you know, with the staffing issues that they're still dealing with, trying to find that balance. So right now, what we're proposing is a minimum use of 5 days a week for 4 hours a day. The other thing is we heard concerns about parking loss and the parking revenue and making sure that that's solvent. We heard issues of the maintenance of it and cleanliness, just keeping it clean, things of that nature. We also heard on the other side too that the parklet plan doesn't go far enough. Some folks said that we need to close full streets and do things that just have full pedestrian environments for folks. And we're not proposing that yet. There needs to be more of a discussion with the downtown businesses for that to happen and work on things about loading zones and things of that nature. But it's quite varied in the feedback we got.
For restaurants, the benefits of having a parklet out front seem much more obvious than the retail spaces in the area. How is the city working to make them beneficial for all businesses downtown?
Sure. That's one of the big themes we've heard in the public outreach was there is a little bit of balance between the restaurant concerns and the non-restaurant businesses. And so one of the things we've proposed is, you know, if you want to encroach into the neighboring frontage, that you need to have the permission of the neighboring business. We allowed a certain level of that during the pilot program. And so going forward in the permanent program, we're going to require that you get the permission of the store next to you. I think the activity level is something that a lot of people had a concern about is, and if the city is going to allow these, that, hey, it better be used. And so I think we heard that loud and clear, and that's something we're proposing to have in the program.
Does the support from the general public seem to be more uniform?
It does. Yeah, the support from the public, I would say, is they like these and they want to see them going forward. But of course, you know, they don't have the economic interest or struggles that the downtown businesses do. So we fully understand that there's going to be that kind of a difference of opinion.
That's a balancing act for sure. So parklets are on the city council agenda, I saw, for both July 5th and July 19th. Can you tell us what will happen on those two dates?
Sure. So we'll be introducing an ordinance, and an ordinance requires two readings. So that's why we have the two meetings, the first one on the 5th and the second one on the 19th. It'll be for adopting the new parklet program and then adopting the fees as well, too, as well as a new parklet guide that we have that sort of lays out all the aspects of the program. You can find out how to apply for a parklet of your own.
Is that the outdoor dining guide that I saw linked on your website?
That is that. Yeah. And you can go to openslow.org to read that guide, and you can find out more details about that. And we'll be providing that in the staff report going into council on the 5th.
Can you give me a sense of what the city staff is going to be recommending in that staff report?
Sure, absolutely. It'll be an updated guide. So we got more input on the encroachment into the neighboring frontage. Before, we were trying to find a balance of, you know, if you're only going a few feet into a neighboring business, you need to have the consent of the next door owner. We're thinking, well, if you're going to be encroaching at all into the neighboring frontage, you need to have the consent of that. So that's one thing we're updating. The fees, the full cost to the city is about $9,000 per year per space. And so we'll likely be recommending the full cost of that to the parklet owner to pay for. And the city council can make a decision if they want to reduce it to be lower than that.
So the $9,000, that's in lost parking revenue that would otherwise come from that space. Is that right?
Yeah, it's a mixture of lost parking revenue as well as maintenance and repaving that needs to happen.
I know you did a ton of outreach already, but if community members are listening and they want to weigh in because they haven't had a chance to do so already, what's the best way for them to do that?
We have an open city hall sign where you can find out what other people have said. If you just go to that openslow.org, you can find a link to that. You can also just get in touch with me. You can email me at afukushi@slowcity.org. You could also give us a call at the city as well, too.
Luke and Adam, thank you so much for coming to the studio today. I really appreciate you being here.
No problem. Anytime. Thanks.
Certainly. Thank you so much.
Now it's time for today's action item. Take a look at the new outdoor dining guide draft on the city's website. There's a link at openslow.org. And if you have questions about it, you can email Adam Fukushima. I will put his address in the show notes. When that draft comes to the city council next month, you can share your thoughts by emailing, calling, or showing up in person to give public comment. And as always, I will put those links in the show notes as well. Today's episode was produced by Sam Reardon with music by Wes Bishop. If you like the show, you can go to agendabreakdown.com to listen to past episodes and follow us on social media. You can also find us and subscribe on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Kim Bishop. See you next time on Agenda Breakdown.
It's time for Working Lunch.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. I'm Jim D'Antona, CEO for the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce and your host today. During COVID, we launched a program called Working Lunch that's connected you with our business community. With all the changes that 2022 has brought us, this is just one more change we can add on. Each month, we'll sit down and talk with a member of our business community to talk about doing business on the Central Coast. We hope you'll join us for these conversations every month on issues and ideas. Today, I'm so pleased to be sitting down with LeBren Harris. Hi, LeBren. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, LeBren is not only the director of sales for Hampton Inn and Suites and the new Town Place Suites Hotel, but our 2022 board chair for the Slow Chamber and the Slow City Tourism Business Improvement District board member. So you have a lot on your plate, and I know you have a very active family. How do you do that?
Well, kind of like everybody else, you just jump in and you just do what you have to do. My family is very active in this community, not just on the playground, but we both, my entire family, just we have so much that we want to give back to this community and to help further progress this community. So it's an important thing in our household to make sure that we do keep San Luis Obispo at the center, top of our minds when we are involved in organizations, when we're volunteering, when we're out in the school segment. And we enjoy it. We love this community. We're here for a reason. We stayed for a reason.
We over at the Chamber have seen your girls in tow with you at city meetings, at Chamber events. Is that something, again, like you were talking about, part of the family ideal, or one of the tough things of working on the Central Coast here with not having childcare and all the other parts of being a working mom?
Everything you just said, we put it all in one. It is tough being a working parent here on the Central Coast. My family and I, we are so blessed to be able to have the support that we have with my in-laws, grandparents and aunts and uncles and cousins that help us at any point. But my husband and I also see the value in making sure our kids are involved to a certain extent, because seeing it at an early age encourages them and shows them later on, once they are grown, whether they're here in San Luis Obispo or not, that it's important to get involved. It's important to stay involved. And it's important, the mission that you have, that you see that mission through.
I said you were part of the Tourism Business Improvement District. What is that?
We are the tourism authority for the city of San Luis Obispo. Some other areas may call it visit such and such, or some may call it a tourism authority, just flat out. But our role is to market San Luis Obispo, whether that comes through events, sponsorships, radio spots, marketing. It's anything that is going to get the word out about San Luis Obispo to get you to come visit. And every time every guest stays in a hotel and has a paying room, they are paying a tax and they're paying an assessment fee. And part of that assessment fee is what goes towards our funding to be able to market San Luis Obispo.
That means competitors in the hotel industry are getting together for the greater good. And it does seem like that's something that happens a lot here in San Luis Obispo. Do you find that with your fellow hoteliers?
You know, and it's not just hoteliers, yes, but also with other businesses that were able to cross work together in many different aspects of the greater region of San Luis Obispo.
The hotels have identified that you all serve different clientele, different areas, and overall, there's enough business for everyone. I think we've seen a lot of business recently. You guys have been staying pretty busy, right?
We sure have. And the great thing about that is there literally is something for everybody. And even for yourself as a traveler, you'll have a different need when you are traveling for business versus when you're traveling with your family versus when you just want to be by yourself. There's a different need that will fit any level of what it is that you need your travel to be. And that's here.
Clearly, government and other organizations have identified that tourism is a huge part of our economy, of our business sector, that we do rely on, right?
Absolutely. Since the TBID has been formed, our second time that we've reached over $1 million in TOT, which is transient occupancy tax. And when you're paying the taxes on every room night that you stay in a hotel, 10.06 out of that goes to the city. And that's kind of how we can measure our success on how we're doing, or our not success if we're not meeting those thresholds. And seeing that for the second time, 2009 is when the T-bidders start tracking. And that's a big feat. Out of 12 months out of the year, and there's only two times that we've achieved over $1 million. And that is also within this fiscal year. And that says a lot. I think what it also says, especially coming out of the pandemic, the one good part of the pandemic is that a lot of locals realize what we have here, and we don't have to travel too far and have a staycation. The pandemic did that. The pandemic showed us that we can stay right here, and that's what's been good. And I honestly believe that's a part of our success, that more folks are deciding to stay and have a staycation and vacation here.
Well, you think about the region, because the numbers you're quoting, the $1 million month, literally is only in the city of San Luis Obispo. Mm-hmm. That doesn't even count what's happening in Paso, in Pismo, and all throughout the rest of the county. Really, you look back on pre-COVID, and the numbers were good. We were certainly a vacation destination. But COVID changed that. We were found by a bigger group, right? I mean, it looks like those numbers have really jumped up high.
Absolutely. And one of the another benefit out of COVID, you know, we kind of think COVID was just such a downturn and so sad and draggy. But for our market in hospitality, it really was a benefit. And the governor had approved, I can't give you the exact dollar amount because I don't remember, but he approved a certain amount to go towards tourism, to encourage folks to travel within the state. That's also another part of the success is that the outside communities have found and realize that there is more within the state of California, and specifically here in San Luis Obispo. And folks, families, they found us, and they now see that you don't have to go so far.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio. The Slo Chamber's Jim D'Antona is speaking with LeBren Harris, board member of the Slo City Tourism Business Improvement District.
Well, one of the things that immediately comes to mind to me is that if you're looking for those extended stays, that might be around some business travelers. Back in March 2020, all business travel ceased to exist, and it was slow to come back. Are we seeing that uptick? Are people traveling for business again?
They are traveling. It's still slow, and it's certainly slower in this market than what it is in other markets. We are still seeing a lot of leisure travel, a lot of family travel. Whereas during the pandemic, the business traveler did stop, they were still traveling. Since they couldn't go to their office, they were still coming and staying in hotels and doing work out of the hotels. They were also staying just to get away because they're tired of being in their house or being in their garage doing their work. Certainly not to the magnitude of what we saw pre-pandemic, and certainly not to the magnitude of now, but there were not as many hotel closures as one would think during the pandemic because hotels were able to be creative.
Well, you talked about folks coming into town graduation weekend at Cal Poly SLO. This is the first graduation we've seen maybe in a couple years of the full group coming in. Were the rooms all booked out? Were we full again?
From what I understand, this is actually probably one of the slower graduation weekends. And when I say slower, that means the entire city didn't sell out like it did in the past. So slow for us in that weekend is about still 92-93% occupancy. But when we're used to seeing the entire city sell out, my understanding is, just talking to hoteliers, that wasn't really the case this year. I think folks still weren't comfortable in being in that big of a crowd setting. Could have potentially been the part in, you know, the gas pump. That kind of pumps the brakes just a little bit for some folks.
It seems that a lot of our tourism comes from the drive markets, right? Mm-hmm. We're 3 hours from LA. We're like 3 hours from San Francisco. We're like 3 hours from Fresno. Do we see that being a large part of our tourism population? And do you think gas is having a pretty significant impact on that?
Yes to both. Yes, the drive markets, again, pointing back to the promotion that came out of the pandemic of staying local, staying in California and traveling, but also it's getting high. I just talked to one of my properties this morning that's down in the Palm Desert area. They're in $7 in gas. They're not moving too much, too far from where they are. But interesting enough is that even though the drive markets is really, I guess, so to speak, our bread and butter, our fly markets are just taking off. This weekend, we went to the airport for dinner for my niece's birthday. We don't have an opportunity to go there very often, but every time we go, it is just so amazing to see the number of flights that are just constantly coming in. If you sit there and you see the flights that are coming in, the flights that are leaving, and that is a lot of folks that are staying, whether they you know, some live here, but there are a significant amount that are coming to vacation. There are a significant amount that are coming to stay. The amount of private jets that are coming in and out, those people are staying. Those people are spending a lot of time here.
There are a lot more articles being written about how wonderful SLO is. So do you think those things are having impacts as they end up in New York or in Europe? We're seeing a lot of new people coming in from far away.
Absolutely. We have an amazing PR team. They know the right places to touch and they know the right places to be able to position us. Because they know that, they're able to put us in the right spots that's going to get the right eyes. So there's a lot of thought and a lot of strategy that's behind how we're being marketed. And I'm not going to say the right folks, but the folks who are going to fly here,
drive here, rent a plane to come here. They're doing it because of the output that the TBID is putting out there. And other entities and organizations are picking up on what the TBID is doing. So it's just continuously spreading.
California, this tourism group, the Visit California, mm-hmm. Visit SoCal, our county group, the city group. Obviously, from a chamber perspective, we're super interested in growing our economy. And that money being spent here is doing that. So one of the main questions, though, that every business is facing is staffing. How is that working for you, and are other hoteliers feeling the strain?
It's tough. It's tough in hospitality, just as it's tough in a restaurant, just as it's tough in any place that you walk in. So I do beg and plead to be kind no matter where you're going. It is tough, and it is a struggle in tourism. Expectations are really high with the traveler. It really is managing not so much the guest expectations, but managing what it is that you know that you can produce, even when you're understaffed. A lot of hotels are being creative with their offerings because they don't have the staffing to be able to keep up with the demand. The demand's going to come or go whether you're ready for it or not. And even though it is a labor shortage in this market, hotels have been able to manage it efficiently so that guests can still feel welcome and comfortable and have a pleasant stay while they're here.
And it's really interesting because there are things happening that maybe we took for granted in the past, you know, having your room turned every day mm-hmm. that maybe wasn't necessary, right? Having your towels, like all of that also has some environmental issues. Are we finding efficiencies in the hotel industry around how we make the programs work with the staff we have and keep those customers happy with their stay?
Absolutely. I can't really speak on every hotel on what their practices are, but I do know that some are not going in every room and cleaning every rooms every day. I know some are not doing the towel service only if you absolutely need it, and will replace it every couple of days. So that kind of stuff, as we know that we are still in a water drought, water shortage, and so that helps. But the environment, another program that the TBID had recently initiated, is the Keys for Trees. You're coming here and you're spending the money here, but we're in turn taking that money and invest it back in this community and this environment and planting trees around the community. And whereas we're spending a lot of money in these hotels to keep things working and functioning, we're trying to put that back in the environment with the amount of trees that we're planting. So it's a great program and appreciated by our guests.
The folks coming and staying at our hotels, they're producing revenue in the hotel side, but then they're going out to our wineries, to our restaurants. Are you finding that COVID helped coalesce some of your other industries to come work with you, or making sure that we are connecting our restaurant industries, our wine industry, our tours?
Absolutely. Collaboration has been everything. The amount of businesses that popped up during COVID, and I don't want to say popped up in that manner, that at the hotel level just did not engage with before the pandemic, we started to engage with during the pandemic, so we knew what was open and what it was that we could recommend for guests to be able to do. And that's just kind of just ballooned and blossomed into beautiful relationships with so many different segments in this community for the betterment of our guests. And a lot of those businesses and organizations have offered for hoteliers to come experience this for yourself, so you know exactly what it is that your guests are going to experience. And pre-COVID, I don't think that was very much of a collaboration as it is right now. So we do work hand in hand. And what most people also don't realize is that restaurants and attractions is hospitality. We're all kind of lumped in the same category. And just makes sense for us just to work together.
All of these things generate taxes paid for by people visiting our community. Mm-hmm. And then those things go to benefit our community. We talked about that. You just mentioned the trees. You mentioned some of these other items. It's really their spending money here has kept our community as beautiful and as wonderful as it is. I want to take a little different turn here just because you're also our board chair for 2022 for the Chamber. Is there a conversation or initiative that you've enjoyed most now that we are halfway through the year, the one you're most excited about?
Oh my gosh. You don't know how excited I am about our SOAR program. Seeing this program that's developed from
just a topic of conversation out of business economic council to where it is getting ready to launch. It is such a privilege and honor to be a part of this that in turn is going back to help the businesses in this community, and it's going to help attract those qualified and those that just want to come here. It's probably the most satisfying part of being a chair.
Maybe you want to share a little bit about what kind of gap we were filling or why that was happening, and the original words where people might know it a little better as.
The Trailing Spouse Program is where the start came from. And what the intent behind it is that as folks are coming and interviewing and looking for jobs or accepting jobs, they're finding that their significant other, their family, their friends, whoever else is coming to travel with them, isn't finding a community, isn't finding job opportunities. It's been a struggle to keep people here, but yet get people to want to accept. So the basis of this program is to be able to provide a community for them for whatever their need is. Maybe they just need a sitter. Maybe they need another job. Maybe they need a house. It's whatever it is that your need is. This program is really provided to help everybody else that's coming with you when you are interviewing or when you've accepted your position here in this area to help you build immediate community.
Yeah, we sit with a community of 280,000 people in our entire county, staffing being such a key issue. Sometimes we're going to have to draw talent from other communities. You weren't originally from San Luis Obispo. Is the social connection a difficult part that you've seen from people coming to the community that might have been an impediment to hiring?
Absolutely. It's no secret that the San Luis Obispo community is not very diverse. And when you're looking at diverse populations or folks who are coming and looking for a diverse community, you're not going to find that here. However, being able to show that there are communities here that you can involve yourself in and be comfortable in and know that you're not here alone or by yourself, it is important for individual success and for family success. And that's what we want to be a part of. We want our business community to be successful as a chamber.
Well, LeBren, thank you so much for joining us today. It's always a pleasure talking with you and really appreciate all that you do for our community. I'm Jim D'Antona, CEO of the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce, and I've been speaking with
LeBren Harris,
our 2022 board chair for the SLO Chamber and the SLO City Tourism Business Improvement District board member. And we thank you all for joining us.
KCSB is a community radio station based at the University of California in Santa Barbara. Up next, student reporter Zoha Malik speaks with Environmental Defense Center senior attorney Maggie Hall about the implications of ExxonMobil's recent lawsuit.
Last month, ExxonMobil filed a lawsuit against the Santa Barbara County Board of Supervisors after the board denied its proposal for an oil trucking project back in March. And on June 3rd, the lawsuit was rejected by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. According to a press release by local environmental advocacy groups such as the Environmental Defense Center, or EDC, and the Santa Barbara Channel Keeper, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals issued an opinion ruling that the federal government violated environmental protection laws when it approved permits for fracking and acidizing from platforms offshore California, agreeing with environmental organizations that the government failed to conduct full environmental review and consultation with relevant groups about potential threats to wildlife. According to News Channel 312, the oil company has sought to reopen their San Ynez unit. This construction site includes three offshore platforms and a processing facility on the Gaviota Coast. It called for up to 24,800 oil-filled truck trips per year on Highway 101 and Route 166 for up to 7 years, or whenever a new coastal oil pipeline was completed. The site shut down in 2015 after the Plains All-American pipeline ruptured and spilled thousands of gallons of oil into the ocean. Senior attorney of the Environmental Defense Center, Maggie Hall.
So the pipeline that ruptured was transporting crude oil from the offshore platforms that operate in the Santa Barbara Channel onshore to be moved ultimately to market. And what happened is when the pipeline ruptured, of course, it devastated the coastline and, you know, resulted in environmental damage that is still to this day being evaluated and restored. And the one of the consequences was that the pipeline rupture resulted in no form of transportation for three of the offshore platforms that operated off of Gaviota. So those three platforms have been offline since 2015.
The EDC is an environmental advocacy group based in Santa Barbara County. I spoke to Maggie about the lawsuit prior to the decision for more information on why offshore oil production poses an issue to our environment.
In terms of the lawsuit, the reason that they filed a lawsuit is because the County of Santa Barbara denied ExxonMobil's application to restart those platforms and truck crude oil along the coastline. So the project would have allowed them to restart the platforms that have been shut down since 2015 when the Plains All American pipeline ruptured and devastated our coastline. It would also have allowed ExxonMobil to transport oil via tanker trucks along Coastal Highway 101, as well as inland along the notoriously dangerous Highway 166. And that would have involved roughly 70 truck trips per day. So that project is what the county denied because of its extreme danger, putting public safety and the environment at risk.
I had reached out to two of the Santa Barbara County supervisors involved in the case, Joan Hartman and Greg Hart, both of whom declined to comment due to an inability to do so during pending litigation. I also reached out to ExxonMobil for comment about the lawsuit, and their spokesperson, Megan McDonald, referred me to ExxonMobil's website and a copy of the complaint ExxonMobil filed against the Board of Supervisors. One part of the complaint, which was written by ExxonMobil attorney Don Sestito, read that, quote, "The board improperly treated the consideration of the project as a referendum on offshore production, as well as the transportation and use of crude oil in the County of Santa Barbara. But that was not the issue before it. The only question was whether the project complies with federal, state, and local law. It does," end quote. Exxon continued on to say that the group had a vested right to restart and operate the San Ynez unit and that the project acted in favor of the environmental cause. According to page 15 of the complaint, they wrote that, quote, "Contrary to the board's intent, the project denial promotes the degradation of the environment in the county and surrounding areas by depriving consumers of a local, lower carbon intensive, and more heavily regulated energy source than foreign produced oil and gas that must now satisfy consumer demand," end quote. They had also revised the project to include a truck hazard mitigation plan meant to minimize the potential for spills and lessen the magnitude of a spill's effects should one occur. Still, changes like this and claims for environmentalism were not comforting to the EDC. Senior Attorney of the Environmental Defense Center, Maggie Hall.
"We respectfully dispute their contentions about, the long-term environmental effects. It's very clear that there would be adverse on the ground, you know, detrimental effects with respect to clean water, air quality, not to mention the unacceptable public safety concerns. There's ample evidence that was presented to the county demonstrating that there's severe risks involved with trucking, which include reports that we submitted, which show that there have been actually 8 tanker trucks accidents along the very proposed route just in the last 15 years. And 6 of those accidents were on Route 166. Those accidents alone caused 6 deaths, oil spills, fires, and injuries. So there's really unacceptable levels of public safety and danger that are at stake with this project. Of course, there are the bigger implications of restarting offshore oil production, which involves exacerbating climate change at a time when we really need to be focusing on renewable energy."
Maggie also contested some of the other claims made by Exxon in their complaint.
ExxonMobil, first of all, makes, you know, exaggerated statements about the county banning all oil in the Santa Barbara Channel. Of course, that's not true. The county only denied the trucking proposal associated with 3 offshore platforms. So it in no way has the ability, nor did it act to ban all of offshore oil. And another interesting thing that they claim is that they have a vested right to resume offshore oil production. But that's not true because any right that ExxonMobil has is tied to their permit approved by the county, which limits their ability to do offshore oil production to a certain form of transportation, and that's pipeline. So without a pipeline available, ExxonMobil does not have a right to operate the offshore platforms, and it certainly does not have a right to truck its oil.
After the lawsuit was rejected, Maggie Hall celebrated the court decision in the EDC and Santa Barbara Channel Keeper press release, citing its protection of California wildlife. She said, quote, "This ruling ensures protection of our waters for wildlife recreation and our tourist economy," end quote.
Zoha Malik is a student reporter at KCSB, a community radio station on the campus of UC Santa Barbara. This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Let's join Father Ian on another culinary adventure.
I love tortillas.
This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Father Ian Dellinger, and I'm playing with food. Dearly.
You'll never know.
Just like Lalo Guerrero is singing, I love tortillas, corn and flour. When I lived in Britain, before and after flour tortillas were commercially available, I would occasionally make my own in order to have a small burrito. Every year, when I would travel back to California, I would visit the local tienda near where I stayed at my friend's, and where corn tortillas were made fresh every day. I would buy a stack of 100 corn tortillas, place them into my suitcase along with a variety of dried chilies, with clothes packed around them, and smuggle them into the UK. Then I would put them in stacks of 8 tortillas in freezer bags. Throughout the year, I would make enchilada sauce with the dried chilies and make some mediocre by taqueria standards, but taste of home, enchiladas, black beans, and Mexican rice a couple times a year. I am thankful I don't have to do that anymore. I only tried to make corn tortillas once, and that was after I moved back to California and had a bag of masa in the cupboard that was purchased for something else. I thought I'd give it a try. It was okay, but not really worth the trouble, since I can buy tortillas literally everywhere I go. But I have long wanted to meet someone who makes beautiful handmade tortillas, and in King City, Isabel Garcia makes tortillas every single day. She graciously made both corn and flour tortillas for me, and her daughter Maggie translated as we went along. This is how it went.
Mi nombre es Isabel. Gracias por invitarnos.
I want to thank you for inviting us. We will start off by making tortillas. It's not the same as it would be in Mexico.
So we've got masa here. So what's different here than in Mexico?
Lo diferente es allá usamos este.
So the difference is that here, the mix comes pre-made, and all you have to do is add water. However, in Mexico, you have to take the dried cob. Once it's dried, you peel off the leaves and everything, and you take the grains, put it to boil with lime and powder, and once it boils, you leave it there overnight, and then the next day, you take it to the mill, that's where it grinds it, and you have to make sure it is smooth. That way you can make the dough.
Y allí ya se hace la masa.
Have you ever made tortillas that way in this country?
La verdad, no.
She has never made them here in this country because she doesn't have the mill that they have back in her hometown. It is different here, and if she were to have that, she would use it. That way it is a smoother milling process.
No hay con qué molerlo.
Great, so let's get started.
Okay, ahorita vamos a empezar a hacer unas tortillas de maseca, pero con polvo de maseca. Lo que vamos a hacer es amasar la masa con agua, un poco agua tibia, y después le echamos un poco agua fría.
We will start off by taking the maize powder, and then you're going to mix it with some warm water first, and then later you will add some cold water. That way it's not too sticky when you are mixing.
Le echo agua caliente, y luego después le echo agua y un poco de agua fría.
So the masa and some water. But what I've noticed is that you're not measuring anything.
In Mexico, depending on where you live, you don't have measuring cups. So that's part of the reason why you have to eyeball or you use your experience to see how much water you can put in. The many times that she's done it, she already can tell whether she needs more water or more flour.
No tienes ni medida ni nada.
So you just know by feel. You can feel that's the right texture.
Sí, es que uno va sintiendo.
She knows by feeling it, and she knows because it doesn't stick to you as much, and she knows how it's supposed to feel. It's not supposed to feel very, very cold or very warm. It's supposed to be at a like room temperature. That's why she adds the warm and the cold water, so it's not as sticky as it could be.
Okay, so you have your ball of dough right here, and so the next thing that you do is you just shape them?
So yes, next thing she does is she shapes the little balls, the dough balls. If she wants them smaller, for example, if we're doing tacos for parties or something, she'll make them smaller so she won't make the dough balls as big. But if she's making them to eat, she'll make them bigger, like a decent size, like the palm of your hand.
This press is wooden. I'm assuming it's from Mexico. It's very beautiful. How long have you had it?
Ya tengo como 15 años.
She's had this for about 15 years now. You can tell she's used it for about 15 years.
You can tell she's used it for a long time. I thought it might be older than that. So three turns in the press and they're super thin.
So it's not at its best capacity. Therefore, she does have to turn it three times and press it three times. However, if she had a better one, she'd only need to do it once and it would come out at the same thin size.
Okay, and then straight on to the stove. And how long do you know to cook them?
So you do two turns. So the first one, you place it on and almost immediately, you wait maybe 1, 2, 3 seconds. Again, she does this by just looking at it. She can tell when it's ready, then you flip it. That's when you leave it there for the longest time. And then it starts to gain a little bit of color. She picks it up and she makes sure that it has the right amount of color and then she turns it again. That is when the tortilla fluffs up, like that, and it has a lot of color.
It really fluffed up. It just puffed right up. Yeah, just like pita bread.
Oh, sí, se esponja mucho. Así es, cuando come calientita, está mejor.
It's beautiful, and you can smell it now. You do one or two at a time on the grill till they're the perfect color. You had a ball of masa about the size of a soccer ball. How many will that make, and how many tortillas do you make a day?
Este es casi como cuando comen nada más una vez.
So she makes it 3 to 4 times. She'll make it about that size if we're only eating once. So if it's like a small meal. From this batch right here, she'll make about 15, maybe 20 tortillas, depending. However, if we are eating like dinner, she will make 1.5 or even twice times that batch because everybody has multiple tortillas. If you add that up, I'd say that'd be like 75, 80 tortillas a day.
How many people are in the family?
We are 6.
Okay. It's like you're eating lots of tortillas, but yes. 6 people will eat a lot of tortillas.
Yes.
So, do I get to taste one?
Oh, pues claro. Por eso traje un poco de comida. Diles que a ver si les gusta un poco mole traje.
She said, of course you can try them, and she brought some food for you to try.
Oh, right. So should we wait till the flour ones are done to do that?
That is entirely up to you. If you would like to taste them right now, we can do that. Or if you want to wait for the flour tortillas, however, I will warn you, I like it when they are very fresh.
I'll taste the corn one now and then we'll get the food out and when the flour ones are done and do them together. Can I just take one and taste it?
You can even put a little bit of salt and it is pretty good to go.
Okay, so sometimes you put salt. Okay, I'm gonna take my mask off. This one just came off the comal, and the comal is basically a metal sheet, right? On the stove. Here we go. This is super hot. Super hot. They are very light. I like the texture. It's got an interesting chewiness to it, and it's nothing like a prepackaged tortilla at all. It is so much better. And what I like about it is the flavor is really light, so that means when you put meat or beans in it, you get to taste the meat or beans and not too much corn.
Sí, es por la razón porque está delgadita.
That is why she makes them thin, so that they're light. However, if you do want a richer flavor, you can make them thicker. So in some cases, some foods do require a thicker tortilla, so she'll make the masa and the dough and she'll make it a little thicker, and then you can taste it more than you can.
Beautiful. Gracias. This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Father Ian in King City making tortillas with Isabel and her daughter Maggie. We just finished making corn tortillas. Tasting them right off of the comal was amazing. So thin and light. I can't wait to have them with the food that Isabel made. But we have one more task. So should we make some flour ones now?
Voy a hacer una harina. Sí.
I say we.
she puts vegetable oil onto the coffee table. That way it does not stick when you are rolling the dough. In her bowl, she'll put in some flour, some water, and some baking powder, and just a little bit of oil. That way the dough is nice.
Nada más poquita.
Same thing with the tortillas before. She does not use any measuring cups. All she does is put in a little bit of flour into her bowl. In this case, she is doing very little because we are not making a lot.
Ahora le voy a echar poquito de este royal.
A little bit of baking powder.
Un poquito. Y un chorrito de aceite.
A little bit of oil.
Y luego voy a echar agua caliente.
The warm water. Okay, mm-hmm. And stir that around.
Mm-hmm.
Wheat flour is much stickier than masa, right?
Sí, este está más pegajoso que la masa de maseca.
So you do struggle a bit more because it is stickier. So sometimes you'll be there for a bit before you realize that it's not sticking to your hands anymore.
Okay. Okay, so you're about ready to roll out the flour tortillas. That's a little stickier than I used to make mine, and I need to learn from that. So you mixed it in the bowl, and now you're giving it a good knead on the table. Okay, that's probably making it stronger.
Sí, para que se mase bien, que quede bien.
You have to make sure that everything gets incorporated. So she makes sure to knead it for a good while, even add some water if it's a little still too dry. You want to make sure that dough is very soft to get the texture you want for your tortillas.
You kneaded it until it was a little bit smooth.
Sí, hasta que esté suave para dejar que se restire.
She makes sure that the dough is soft so that it is easier for it to stretch.
Rolling it into a ball and about ready to roll it out. How exciting.
Se le echan en el polvo para que no se pegue.
Ah, so you take your ball that you're about ready to roll out and then you dust it in flour like you would a Mexican wedding cake with powdered sugar. So you just completely dust it in flour. You don't just sprinkle it on. You kind of completely dust it in flour.
Sí, se cubre para que no se pegue ni aquí ni acá.
That is super thin. You can see through it.
Oh, sí, poquito.
Those are pretty thin, and after she grabs it, she does stretch it out to make sure it's even thinner or it's even bigger. However, you can make them thinner if you make your dough just a little bit more smoother.
Okay, and then they go on a lower heat, you said. Again, how do you know when they're done?
Como es tortilla de harina, se necesita más bajito el fuego para que no se queme, porque la tortilla de harina se cose muy rápido. Es por eso lo bajo la lumbre.
One at a time, obviously, so you can pay attention to it so it doesn't burn?
Sí, para que no se queme.
They cook very fast, and therefore she can only make one at a time unless she has somebody helping her to keep an eye to make sure it doesn't burn.
So lots of turns and rolling to get it really thin. Why don't you use the press?
Es que tortilla de harina, lo pachurras, no se restira.
When using a press, so if you do take the ball and you press it onto it, it will not, for the life of it, stretch. Maybe it'll grow like an inch, half an inch, but it'll stay that way. That's why she uses the rolling pin to get all the sides. She flips it. You can't see it, but they do shrink back a bit once she turns over. But she just keeps stretching, because if you do it just once or twice and you just press on it, it won't grow and it won't stretch.
So you have to keep stretching it. You know, since it's flour, I suppose it's kind of like when you're making pizza dough, they spin it in the air so it stretches and stretches and stretches and stretches.
Oh, sí. Es lo mismo casi eso, pero... Que este está delgadito, pero eso está...
Looks like the only difference would be that this is thinner and that one's a little bit thicker.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever make flour tortillas that are big enough to make burritos with?
She used to make them more often because she used to make food for workers in the field. Oh, she'd make them the night before. She'd make them really big so she can make burritos for the next day.
How often do you make tortillas?
La tortilla es allá en México. Siempre.
When you're in Mexico, you eat tortillas every single day with all kinds of food. Even with newborns, you give them a small little tortilla, you roll it up, and that's what they eat because they don't have specific baby foods prescribed by doctors. So over there, they do eat it every single day. And for us, we have tortillas every single day. So make these about two or three times a day.
Two or three times a day?
Two or three times a day, yes.
Oh, sí. Pues cada vez que tienen hambre, cualquier mis hijos, yo lo hago los tres veces.
So make us a batch for whenever we're hungry because we all eat them.
Wow, why don't you make a big batch for the week?
Porque les gustan recién hecha, calientita. Ya cuando está recalentado es otro sabor.
My brother and I, all of us can agree that they taste different when they have just come out of the comal than when you reheat them. So sometimes when she's gone, and like for example when I was young and I had a babysitter, she'd pack them for me and I would reheat them, but it's not the same as when you have it straight out of like the fire.
You're listening to KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian, and Isabel from King City just made corn and flour tortillas from hand. She makes them every day. Now that the tortillas are done, it's the time I've been waiting for, eating the tortillas with the food. But first, is tortilla making really something Isabel enjoys?
This must be something that you really love to do, and you really love to do for other people, because you make tortillas 3 or 4 times a day for your family, but you also, how often do you make tortillas for other people? I mean, Padre Filemon told me that he asked for 50 tortillas and you gave him 250 for his, was it Christmas dinner or New Year's dinner with his family? So this must be your labor of love.
Sí, a mí me gusta hacerlo. Me gusta cocinar. Me gusta.
She loves to cook. She loves anything that has to do with the kitchen. She'll make tortillas, of course. She does it. She says she loves doing it. She gets excited about doing it, or even when she tries out something new. It's exciting, and she loves it, and she does it with love. So it is very much flavorful.
When you're not eating Mexican food, what's your favorite cuisine?
Pues muy poco de las veces lo que es.
On occasion, she will have a hamburger from one of the fast food stores, and she'll only have that once a week or sometimes even twice a month. She won't have it as often because to her, it does not replace her homemade tortillas and homemade food. She does enjoy Chinese food, so she'll have that too.
Have you ever put a different cuisine into a tortilla? Like if you had leftover Chinese food and the next day you ate your Chinese food with tortillas?
No. No le he hecho, pero sí me da ganas de hacerlo, sí.
So she hasn't done it, but it just came to mind. She says she does sometimes feel like doing it. However, I notice that whenever we have KFC, we cannot have it without tortillas. It is just, we can't have KFC without tortillas. That's how we grew up. So we'll take, whenever we go to KFC, well, there's a table that sometimes we sit at. We'll take tortillas. She'll make them here. We'll leave right after, she'll take a salsa, and then we'll have tortillas with KFC. They're fried chicken.
That means you don't eat the biscuit?
We love the biscuits, actually. Dice que como ves que a veces comemos KFC con tortillas, que si no nos comemos el biscuit, pero le digo que sí, nos encanta el biscuit. Usted no.
Pero yo no.
She will not eat the biscuit, but we will.
Yo con tortilla, toda la comida con tortilla. Si no hay comida, yo con salsa nomás y sal. Con eso como mis tortillas a gusto.
For her, it is tortillas and tortillas only. If she had them out, it'd be tortillas for life. Because no matter if she doesn't have any food, she'll put in a little bit of salsa or a little bit of salt, and she is good for that meal. That is, she needs to have her tortillas, though.
Padre Filemon told me that you make the best corn tortillas, but you just used 2 ingredients, which you bought at the store. What makes yours better than everybody else's if you're just using these 2 ingredients and you didn't process the corn yourself?
Es que la manera de que...
A lot of it has to do with the way you knead the dough. Some people don't know exactly how to properly knead the dough, so it'll come out, the tortilla will come out a little bit too hard, or maybe it'll come out too thin and it'll rip, but she makes sure that the dough is firm, it's not sticking to you, and that when you put it on the comal, you flip it at the right time. If not, it doesn't fluff up.
Is it possible that yours are better because of the love that you put into making them?
También puede ser, sí, porque lo hago con amor. Yo tengo.
It is very possible to say that she does it with joy, especially making it for her kids, and because it's nostalgic for her, because that's all she did when she was in her hometown. Here, she does not like to eat tortillas that already come in a bag. She will not eat them. If she does not have her tortillas every day, she is not full, she's not satisfied. So she does do it with love, she does it with joy. She absolutely loves doing it.
Tortilla making with Isabel and Maggie was amazing. Isabel is so fast, and with just two ingredients, plus her love, she makes tortillas that her priest, Padre Philemon of St. Mark's Episcopal Church in King City, says are the best tortillas ever. Tortilla making looks easy, and to some extent it is, but the skill and love put into it definitely makes a difference. If you ever have the opportunity to get your hands on handmade tortillas, you'll never go back. This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian, and I'm playing with food.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments, kcbx.org.